Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 298 featuring Scott Meadows, head of visualization and virtual production at Digital Domain, and a good friend of mine. I've worked with Scott quite a bit back in the day when I was doing visual effects with on Tron and a few other features with him. Really great guy, really smart guy, really humble guy, but he knows his stuff, right, Kristen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. His whole story from, like, you know, he talked about from where he was in college to working his way up into Hollywood. It's awesome. If you want to learn about previz, yeah, listen to this podcast. He talks, you know, in depth about it, and he's worked on so many awesome films. So it's a really amazing podcast.
Yeah, it's really good. And we do to talk about, obviously, virtual production quite a bit and how, you know, how that's changing in the landscape and what's going on recently that's you know, changed the way that people think about virtual production and previz also, how it all kind of blends together. So it's really cool to have him on and to hear to all of those ideas that he's talking about. Yeah, good guy. Really good guy. Cool. We have a couple of announcements. What are they?
So the first event, well, you can find this out at chaosgroup.com/events, but it's the Illumination Challenge, which we've talked about last month or so, but the deadline will be November 30th, and you can win V-Ray, Corona licenses, and cloud credits. The second one, you can sign up for this online, and it's going to be October 27th, and Jim Lammers, who's president and CEO of Trinity 3D, he was on the podcast, I don't know, 5-6 months ago. He'll be demonstrating V-Ray 5 for SketchUp right before the beta. So it'll be really cool.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Yeah, it's really going to be cool to have Jim on because, well, Jim was, yeah, when was it on podcast? Probably about in April or something like that.
Wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, so he's really cool and really cool to find out about SketchUp, V-Ray for SketchUp. There's a lot of new features that are in there in the beta. That is one of the products that's out there that we're doing V-Ray 5 stuff. So check it out on our site, chaosgroup.com. We have a lot of other announcements coming up. So just keep an eye on the site, chaosgroup.com, for all of your V-Ray needs. Or your Phoenix needs as well. Okay, great. If you want to know more about the podcast, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Great. And of course, you can always email us labs@chaosgroup.com and we will respond to those emails, hopefully, if they don't get lost in my mailbox, which has happened before. You'll be able to, we'll have some great ideas of podcasts that you guys want. Just let us know and we'll be able to figure out if we can get them into the schedule. And remember, Apple Podcasts is also a great place for you to leave a review and a rating of our show and share it with your friends. That'd be really cool. Last reminder is we actually are on YouTube and as our Facebook page, we do videos now. So if you want to see it, I'm actually experimenting with the new NVIDIA broadcast and that's how I'm doing this virtual background stuff. It's pretty cool, actually. It's not bad. It's fun. Hopefully the audio sounds good too. All right. With that being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Mr. Scott Meadows.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Okay, all right. First of all, let's have some origin stories. So I knew you from DDD and we worked together, but you were also close friends with Stephen Parker. I think you guys went to A&M together, right?
Yep, that's correct.
Yeah. So let's do that. Let's start a little origin story. How did it all start off?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I guess, you know, graduated high school in 92 and headed over to Texas A&M to pursue what I thought was nuclear engineering. got over there and then just realized didn't like math as much as I thought I did. And that's when they were like, okay, well, what about architecture? And I was like, architecture, that sounds kind of cool, you know? And then I went over and met with the dean and you know, started to enroll and they were like, well, do you want to take drawing or design first? And I was like, drawing? You mean I have to draw? So, right. You know, and that was sort of the beginning, you know, obviously.
So you'd never really done anything artistic before that?
Not really. I mean, my family was very artistic. My grandmother, my dad was a painter and did a lot of stitcheries and worked with her hand, did stained glass. My dad went to art school. But for some reason, I just never really got into it. I was always doing sports and was really into skateboarding and got really into cycling and just never really did it. And then, you know, architecture opened my eyes to all kinds of things. You know, I took a design class and ended up studying abroad in Italy, which was huge. I mean, just was very much into the design aspect of it. Wasn't really into any of the mechanical side. I tried to take all of the professors that were very much into the abstract, you know, kind of design principles.
Right.
And then, you know, through that, basically took black and white photography. And then there was a color class that was taught at the graduate level, but they didn't have enough people to fill it. So my photography instructor reached out to me and said, hey, you know, do you want to take this course? I can recommend you. And so I got into the course and, you know, one of the woman that taught it was on the board in the visualization lab, which was the graduate program for VFX at A&M at the time.
Right. And this was in 90s. Didn't that open around 93?
Yeah. So, but I was there, you know, this is when I was an undergrad. So it was like my junior year. So it was like 96 or so, 95.
Right.
And anyway, like, towards the end of that class, I mean, I really enjoyed the class. I learned Photoshop. That was the first time, really, when I first started to use a computer. I mean, I'd play games, but I remember I bought a Mac Power PC that was like $4,000, you know, that was my, at the time, which was very expensive. And, you know, got into Photoshop and color photography. And then at the end of the course, the professor was like, well, you know, I really think you should, you know, apply to the VisLab. And at the time I was like, I don't know, you know, it was very exclusive and it was a lot of...
It's really hard to get into.
Yeah, it was really hard to get into, basically. They had, you know, design people and then they had, you know, a lot of computer science people and, you know, cross-trained everybody. And so I had a really good portfolio and I think they liked my diversity. And I think obviously, you know, spending time with that professor helped a lot. So I sort of changed course, got into the lab, you know, studied like crazy. I actually had to take an engineering class because my math was kind of weak. I had to take an engineering class in summer school.
Wow.
And I had to make a B or above to get into the program. And of course, you know, I studied my butt off and got an A and got into it. And yeah, it was kind of just sort of all unfolded in front of me. And then once I got into the program, you know, I took programming and I wrote a ray tracer and actually did my thesis using a ray tracer. And just found I really wasn't, you know, I mean, I liked it for the thesis purpose of it because it was very concrete and I could really define it. I started, you know, one of my ideas was to like talk about David Lynch and the way his, you know, his cinematic sense, you know, and I was just like, no way, I'll never finish my, you know, I'll never finish my thesis. So I shifted over and did this kind of a study where I took my ray tracer and I basically read in, you could read in any image file and it would go through each pixel and look at the color of the pixel and that became your camera position. And then it would, you know, shoot a ray. And so it just made these insane images. And, you know, I would write, wrote a little Mel script where I could, this is when Maya first came out. You know, I could assemble, you know, scenes using spheres and cubes because that's all the, my ray tracer would work with. But basically, you know, it would kick out a text file. And then it would, I would feed it in command line, you know, this was all on Irix.
Right.
And yeah, it would just generate these crazy images. And so just kind of wrote about it and it was great for a thesis project and managed to get my master's, which was challenging at the time because a lot of guys back then, everyone was getting hired by Pixar and ILM and all these technical places that really needed artists with technical skills. And so
and there was no other school like that.
Not really. There were,
and it was really important. Like it was really what kind of made, you know, this is, you know, A&M's VisLab back in the late '90s was like the place to be and people coming out of that school really knew everything. And yeah, PDI would hire them. Pixar would hire them.
Yeah.
ILM would hire them.
Yeah.
It was a really big deal. So yeah.
And so then, you know, and it was interesting though, of course, by the time I graduated, that wave had sort of crashed. And so then they weren't hiring as many people straight out of school. And that's when Steve Parker and I, you know, I had planned to move to San Francisco. I had some friends there. I was just going to go. I had a room rented at their house. I was going to move out there and just see what I could find. I didn't have anything lined up. But then Steve went down to Austin and there was a startup company there called Zippity. And they had a bunch of startup money and they were hiring people and it was a small group. And the guy that interviewed me, the guys that interviewed me were this guy Cliff Muller and Oliver Moore, who ended up going on and founding Tweak with a few other guys in San Francisco. But anyway, so these guys were all from LA. They were in Austin. Steven called me up and said, "Hey man, you should come work on this game. You know, it's great pay. These guys are cool. They seem to know what they're doing." So anyway, I shifted my plans. I moved to Austin. We were there working, you know, for probably 6 months. And then of course they ran out of funding and it all kind of went away. Steve went back to A&M and finished up his degree. And then I stuck around and was doing all kinds of odd jobs and whatnot in Austin until someone basically, I was sending out demo reels. I was interviewing all these game companies and basically they said, you know, somebody contacted me and just said, "Hey man, if you want to get into this industry, you got to move to LA, you know, you should just do it." So I did, came out here, slept on Cliff Muller, the guy who was in Austin. He was back in LA. I slept on his floor for a month. I painted houses for his mom out in Westlake Village. Then I got a small job at this place called Milne Effects, which it was just a Scott Milne, who was the chief, he was the owner, and it was a flame artist, and myself. And so I did, you know, I would show up, make coffee, sweep the porch, do 3D, do flame assist, do all kinds of stuff, just whatever they threw at me. And until then Oliver, who had originally interviewed me, you know, in Austin, he was working at Cinesite, and he had done some previs on Daredevil, and this was kind of early on. And so basically then he called me up out of the blue and said, "Hey, do you want to do previs with me on Bad Boys 2 with Michael Bay?" And I'm like, "What's previs?"
Right.
What is that? So anyway, the rest is kind of history. I mean, we went down there and he and I, it was just two of us, you know, we did the whole show. We worked, you know, we worked with Rob Legato. We moved over to Sony and I was like right outside of his office and, you know, worked with him there and then was freelance, went to Van Helsing after that and Lion Witch in the Wardrobe and Prince Caspian. Anyway, and then eventually came to the point where my first supervising gig was Voyage of the Dawn Treader, which was the third Narnia film. And I'd worked on it for 6 months and it went on hiatus. And so then basically during that time, Steve Parker was at DD, actually, I'm not sure if he was there yet or not, but he knew Lala and knew that they were looking for a previous supervisor. And it just so happened that I had just been put on hiatus. So I went over there, went through a couple interviews, you know, three actually. First met with Eric Barba and Lisa, and then met with Ed Ulbrich, and then had to meet with Joe Kaczynski as well. And then got the job and, you know, basically just did previz layout. That's where you and I met, and just kind of kept going. And just from then on, just went from show to show. And I've been at DD, I guess it's like 11 years now, 11 or 12. Wow. Yeah.
I keep saying that. And I'm like, "Oh my gosh." And then I realized that, but because my son was born when I started at DD.
Yeah.
Went back to DD for Tron. Mm-hmm. And so that's 11 years. So,
yep. It's about when my son was like, he was like a year old or something. So it's about the same time. So anyway, and then, just, you know, pre-visit DD, trying to start a department there. And, you know, it was difficult, obviously, just because of me being a previs guy and, you know, visual effects being visual effects and not quite understanding all of that. But it was a good journey just because, you know, we started out doing Tron, you know, in the visual effects pipeline, doing everything in Linux. We didn't even have Photoshop or anything, did everything with Nuke and GIMP and all of that. And it was hard, but it was actually really good because learned a lot of pipeline stuff and learned the DD pipeline. as well.
Well, you had to integrate with layout, and that's,
well, I was the layout supervisor.
You were the layout supervisor, right?
Yeah. So yeah. you learn a lot of lessons really quickly, just like how to not cheat stuff, how you know how to be clean about it. And so it was very interesting because we set up basically two shows where, you know, we had all the previs was done. And then when it was time to go into the final shots, we literally just referenced those files in and swapped the assets and published them out. We were doing, it was a stereo show. So we set the stereo interocular, you know, distances and settings and did the test renders, and that kind of went straight into animation. So yeah, it was a great show. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, after that, just realized after a while that, you know, working in the visual effects pipeline wasn't the best, most efficient way to do previs. So, sure. You know, since then we kind of spun out and, you know, built our own Windows pipeline. And then, it was just show to show. And then of course, you know, the latest thing would be taking over, you know, getting into virtual production, you know, now, about 3 years ago, you know,
I want to get into that. I want to get into in a second, but I think I don't want to gloss. We glossed over a couple things. First of all, Bad Boys 2 was your first kind of like big show that you worked on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what year was that approximately?
Oh, it was 2001 or 2002, something like
okay.
that.
Okay. All right. So a lot of time between then, like 18 years then and now.
Yeah.
So Previs, let's get a little bit of a, you know, what was Previs back then? What was it for? You know, what would people use it for?
Yeah. Well, I'll never forget because Mr. Bay came in and the first thing he says, you know, is, I don't want you guys wasting any fucking time on backgrounds. I don't want you texturing anything. I just want cool shots. I don't want you cutting anything together. You know, I just want cool shots and then I'll look at them. So we're like, of course, yes, sir. And then of course, by the time the sequence was done, we, of course, you know, Rob Legato came in, he was cutting it together. It had sound, you know, he changed his mind, but yeah, it just started out very much just trying to design cool shots for him. And, you know, we moved as fast as we can. We were only two people, so it wasn't split up like it is now. You know, now there are people that are, it's more like a VFX pipeline where there's asset specialist and animation specialist. You know, Oliver and I did it all. Like, he did a lot of the rigging and technical setup, but then I was doing shots, but I would model and, you know, got a real generalist, you know, kind of approach to everything. But everything was much simpler. You know, obviously, you know, Viewport 2.0 wasn't around. And so you had to kind of cheat as much as you can. And it was all about getting it real time. And then, you know, from the, you know, the creative standpoint, I think it was still the same. It wasn't, you know, because no one was really doing it that much, there wasn't a bar that you had to hit. You were just trying to make it look as good as you possibly could. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I had animator friends and other people in visual effects, you know, and they'd be like, you know, why are you guys trying to make this stuff look good? I mean, it's just for blocking, you know, like, why are you wasting time? And I'm like, man, because it sells it. I mean, you know, because I saw the power of it. You see how.
Well, that's the thing, right? You have to sell the shot. You have mm-hmm. to sort of tell, you have to go to Michael Bay and say, mm-hmm. check this out. That's a cool shot. And then he's going to say, yeah, people are wanting to go see that movie because of how that shot looks, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so that's kind of where it started opening up from there, you know, from moving forward. We just tried to texture and put as many, you know, have every representation of what is in a shot, you know, in the previs, whether it's, you know, a little bit of dynamics or effects or lighting, animation, obviously any subtleties, of course, camera was always huge. I mean, it hasn't changed that much other than the quality level has just gone up and up and up and the throughput and the amount of detail, you know, keyframing versus, you know, using mocap and all of, you know, the newer tools and obviously.
So you don't have much time to actually make a shot, right? Like what's your timeline? Like, you know, it's like, okay, I want to see, there's going to be a shot going here. Let me see what that could look like. And you have like, what, a day?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say on average it's a day, probably, you know, depends on how complicated it is. Right. I mean, you know, I would say a complex shot a day to get a rough pass, but yeah, the speed is quite a bit different. I mean, that's where, you know, it's always interesting because notoriously everyone's been like, oh, well, you know, there's this animator that he's been working in features. He could be great at previs. I'm like, we'll see. I mean, some are and some aren't, but a lot of it's, it's just a completely different pace. It's a completely different kind of mindset. You know, you're really, and you're trying to focus on the story, especially on the supervisory end. You know, I think that's where, you know, it's interesting, the different range of different types of supervisors. You know, some are kind of more complex, you know, more focused on the technical side, but I've always been so interested in the kind of bigger picture and trying to focus on the story as much as possible.
Right.
So, you know,
what are some of, I mean, obviously, you know, there's always been this danger with previs a little bit, and I'm sure you're aware of it, that, like, you know, a lot of decisions get made in previs, which sometimes people are very, very, very rigid to that previs, and it doesn't necessarily evolve the way it should. And sometimes people are very sloppy with previs, where there's a constant changing of plan where the previs becomes kind of like useless in the end. So what are, I mean, that's the problem. It's like, I remember there was one show where I'd worked on, and it was for the movie 21, the card counting guys. Remember that it was with the, it was an opening sequence for the movie 21. And basically it's the guys who were counting cards. I think it was with, Kevin Spacey was in it. They were the MIT guys who were counting cards, whatever. But it was, they wanted a CG shot of like the poker table or the blackjack table. And then all these cards were like real super macro shots. And it was, had, they only could do it in CG, right? But they did a previs for it. And they got so, the previs was done just, you know, blocking, showing you how it is. There was no physics to the actual card. So I started adding real physics to things. And they're like, but that doesn't look exactly like the previs. And they started matching it pixel by pixel to the previs. I was like, really? Okay.
No, I know. I mean, it's definitely part of it. And it's interesting. Like, that part of it has evolved quite a lot because, because there were times like in the early days where, you know, I remember, I think I'm trying to remember which film it was, but certain directors, they would, we would previs stuff. And then once it got to the actual shoot day, they would just be like, okay, well, I'm doing this. So, you know, like, this is great. This is great for planning, but I'm going to, these shots are going to change and I'm going to do whatever. So, but over the years, that's slowly gone away. You know, I feel like directors and studios and producers are realizing, hey, you know, we're really, we're spending real money on these, on previs. So, you know, that's what it's for, is to make sure that we use it as a blueprint. And I remember working with Chris Columbus on Pixels, and, you know, there was a state where we actually went, like, they went to the location and we had done all this previs and this for lighting direction or whatever, that we need to change the line of action and flop all the shots. And we went back and changed everything because he knew, he was using it as a template and knew that if I get all these shots that we've prevised, then I know I have this, some semblance of a film here. And if I want to deviate from that, I can. But, you know, I think it's really gotten a lot more, you know, this is the blueprint. And then obviously with COVID and all these things, it opens it up even more. You know, I've been talking to tons of folks, obviously that's a huge thing. And just talking about how, you know, and that's when sort of tech viz and post viz and all these different, you know, these different variations and flavors of previz, you know, have evolved.
So, okay. You mentioned Chris Columbus, but you have the previous supervisor especially has to have a very close relationship with the director.
Yeah.
Right. You have to be able to say, you are basically taking their vision and saying, this is what it's going to look like. And this sort of helping them gut check their feelings. And then it's like, okay, great. Now that I can see it, we can start planning for this. How do you do that? How do you foster that relationship? And how does that happen?
Sure. I mean, I feel like one of the biggest things is just to listen. You know, and to kind of sit back, like, you know, I'm not you know me well enough. I'm not a super boisterous person. I mean, I am an observer. And so one of the main things I try to do is just really listen to everything and kind of read the script and try to understand the vibe of the whole film. Obviously looking at the films that they've made before, and you get a sense fairly quickly, like what they're into and what they're not into. Like, for example, you know, Joe Kaczynski, obviously, you know, very particular about his cameras, doesn't like any roll, loves symmetry, you know, loves the whole, you know, obviously the realism of it and, you know, how would I shoot this? And so, you know, those are, you know, rules and tools that I've adopted over the years and, you know, use every day. Like, you know, how would you shoot this? You know, what kind of setup would I use and how does that influence what the camera move is? You know, even when you're dealing with a Marvel show where you're doing all kinds of crazy stuff, I feel like, you know, grounding that in realism. But, you know, as far as fostering the relationship, I think, again, it's listening a lot, obviously, trying to know when to pitch ideas and not, you know, how to read the room. You know, obviously, like working with Spielberg, he was very clear on what he wanted, but there were still opportunities to pitch stuff, you know, that got into the film. So, I mean, you know, everyone's
different.
You've worked
with Spielberg quite a bit, right?
Like, I've worked with him on two films. I worked with him on, I mean, Ready Player One was a big one, but we also did some shots on West Side Story.
Okay.
As well.
Yeah, because I think that's the thing, right? Once you be able to say, okay, you know, like someone iconic like Spielberg, you've seen all his movies, right? So you have to think to yourself, like, does this look like a Spielberg film?
Yeah. No, I remember there was a shot in the car chase on Ready Player One where we literally ripped off one of his shots from Jurassic Park, and he was like, I don't know if I want to do that. Let's not do that. So it's interesting. Yeah, and everybody's different, and some directors aren't as interested in the previs. You know, a lot of times they're more right. They have come from a writing background, and they're more or focused on the comedy of it all. And a lot of times then they kind of, once you have a good rapport with them and they trust you, then you're focusing on, you know, a lot of this stuff, and you're basically just kind of giving them options and, you know, kind of handling a lot of the, you know, the action stuff where they're focusing on other things. So it really just kind of depends. 'Cause like Gavin Hood, for example, on Ender's Game, you know, he wanted to, I'll never forget, because when we first started, it was a very small group, because I did the teaser with him that got the film greenlit. And that was just me and him working. You know, we would literally do a shot in Maya, and then I would turn over here to the Avid and I would cut it in. And it was hilarious because we'd be in the Avid and he would be like, oh, let's change the camera. And I'm like, oh, wait, hold on. This is it. This is editorial. 3D's over here. So let's go. And then we would go over there and we would, you know, update the shot. And we literally would go through it shot by shot. I would fix it, you know, right there. And that's the other thing, like, you know, part of the previs thing is the whole presentation of it all, which reminds me of architecture, you know, like how you have to present your projects and, you know, getting in front and kind of describing what you're doing and what you're trying to achieve and how you did it. And, you know, and then doing the real time sessions, you know, like I remember once at DD, like on a commercial, it was a Halo commercial.
I worked on that one.
Yeah. So I said, I don't know if you remember.
With Joe, right?
Yeah. With Joe. Yeah. So I did all the previs on my own. I think.
I remember.
And, it was a lot of work. And I don't know if you remember, we went into the screening room and we had it set up where I literally had the clients in the screening room and I was animating the end shot, and I would tweak it and then we'd look at it, tweak it, look at it. And it was like a flame suite, you know, where you're just updating it. So there's a lot of that, you know, working under pressure and kind of being calm. And so I think there's a lot of that goes into the previs supervisor role, and obviously dealing with artists. I mean, I feel like that's one of the most challenging things, is, which is not that different than visual effects. I mean, you know, you're trying you're working with other really smart people and artists themselves, and how do you allow them to express themselves and have, you know, input, and have ideas, but yet also keep things on track and not deviate from what the director wants, because ultimately you're responsible for that. I remember that's one of the hardest things, is when you have someone that's like super excited about an idea and they pitch it, and then you have to be like, well, I think it's a very cool idea. However, it doesn't fit within this film, you know, like basically like, how do you keep people motivated and keep people engaged, but also making sure that it fits, and, you know, you're kind of like an editor in a sense.
Yeah. And that's the thing, right? Because it's a lot of, you know, a lot of previs these days is, especially, it's about selling a shot. Like, here, check out the shot. It's really cool. But it's not always contextually working, right? Like when you were talking about what you were doing, is like, not every shot has to be beautiful, because otherwise it's just too much stuff. You have to lead up to that and sort of build a crescendo, right?
Yeah. And the right shot for the right film at the right time, you know, like there could be a really cool shot, but maybe it doesn't make sense in the sequence, because the sequence is not, you know, doesn't have the same vibe. So I think that's a big thing, you know, to keep an eye on.
Well, you also made a, you were hinting at the, you know, the fact that previs was really like, okay, here's showing the director what it could look like or how to sort of plan for it. But because of that ability of saying, okay, once the director likes that, then you can take that same thing and go to the DP and say, here's how we think it, like, and what do you, how would you shoot it? So this would help the DP plan for that. And then sometimes you can actually dummy up, okay, we're going to do this as a crane shot. So can we actually do it as a crane shot? Do we do motion control? All those things. So you become way more technical all of a sudden. You went from like a loose idea to an extremely technical how to pull it off thing, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, seeing the whole thing through, like, the, you know, I haven't, it's interesting because, like, for as long as I've been in this business, like, my credit, I haven't worked on that many films, because all the films that I've worked on for like years. Like I was on like Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. I was on that movie like 3 years, like, cause I did like, cause I did two shots from home, you know, final shots. I did post-viz. That was the first time I ever did post-viz. You know, I went to New Zealand. So a lot of times I'm on these shows for a very long time. I mean, Ender's Game, very long time. You know, most of them, just because I usually do kind of jump into every, you know, aspect of it, where you're doing pre-viz, the tech viz, go on set, do post-viz, help out, you know.
Explain post-viz.
Well, you know, post-viz is basically pre-viz with plates. You know, it's like, it's like after they've shot the film and, you know, now they want to start assembling it. And if it's all a bunch of blue, how are you going to make decisions and start kind of crafting the sequence further? So post-viz has become just as important, especially, you know, like on a show, like a Marvel show, where you have so much action and so much full CG, you know, what ends up happening is, you know, you'll design all these sequences in previs, then you go and you shoot them and you kind of get what you get. I mean, you do the best that you can, and then you reassemble all of that and you see what you have. And then you use post-viz to then sort of temp it out again and sort of allow you to continue to form the sequence, and then ultimately potentially go do reshoots, or that then goes to the vendors, which then take it to final. So yeah, it's super important as well.
Yeah. But Tron, obviously, and as are a lot of films, including Ender's Game, et cetera, there were a lot of all CG stuff that was going on there.
Right.
So you sort of bypass the whole plate and just go you go from previs to like, all right, final now we shot. Just make it a fixed camera, fixed camera, and put in the real assets and we're done.
I mean, previs is definitely like, for when it's not so, like, you know, Tron and some of those full CG films, even like Ready Player One, same kind of deal. I mean, it was a little different with Ready Player One just because of all the performance capture that had to go into it. But still, you know, you have a lot more control and you're not having to deal with plates. When you're doing more location-based previs, then that's where you get into, okay, well, how can we design the sequence before they know what the location is? And now that they have the location, you know, now we have to go back and basically retrofit it into this new location. And so you're kind of doing things, you know, kind of revisiting stuff. Although now, you know, on some of the newer films we've been working on, you know, just the ability with Google Earth and all these different tools where you can get in there. You know, a lot of times we'll just go in and, you know, I've been doing photogrammetry on Google Earth.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's other ways to extract the data, but one of the fastest ways is I just go into Google Earth and I just screen capture and then run it through, you know, reality capture, and you get a mesh, and that way you've got a location right there, and, you know, you can start animating in it right away, and that's the actual location. So stuff like that has been a game changer, you know, because that was always so tedious to, like, design a sequence. Then you go on location, then you have to you survey it, and you go back and you're kludging together stuff with, like, you know, doing just 2D maps and trying to make it as accurate as you can. But yeah, some of the new technology with that. And then obviously, like, Google Earth, like VR. So I've even been using that, where I'll just do a screen capture and I'll use my head as the camera move, just to kind of come up with new idea, you know, just quickly, just to be like, hey, what if this is a location, and I'll look down one street and then I whip pan over here to, you know, and just record that, throw that into the edit, just as a placeholder. Cool. So yeah, there's so many, I mean, That's the thing, like with COVID and all that. I mean, I'm kind of veering off here, but like basically all the new tools and VR and all that stuff, you know, you're relying on it more and more and exploring it.
Yeah. Well, I do want to get into like, you know, how this is, you know, COVID has affected you and you know, I suspect there's actually probably a lot of previews now, because people are planning movies, but not making
absolutely
movies.
Yeah, no, I mean, we've been absolutely slammed. I mean, since March, like since it happened, like I was, you know, when we first kind of went work from home, I mean, Didi did a great job of handling all of that. We didn't have a lot of it in place, but we got it in place very quickly. And luckily, you know, my team was fantastic and we're able to kind of write tools and figure stuff out so that we could get people working. But basically, you know, I'd get on and because we had to work in shifts at the beginning because of the VPN load and just traffic and stuff. So like I was on at 7 a.m. until 1 a.m. for, you know, a couple of months.
Wow.
So it was just, you know, and I'm set up at my house here. Like I'm in my garage now that I'd luckily had just converted. So, you know, it's right there. You can just walk in there and work as much as you want. So I think that's the biggest thing I've been struggling with is like, how do I set up boundaries? Because everything's here and accessible. So it's just like constantly jump in here.
It's been a little tough. I mean,
yeah.
And you live up actually further than I do, right? Up in that
area. Yeah.
So,
yep.
So I'm just grateful I don't have to drive all the way to Culver City. And you had a long drive.
No, for sure.
Because that gave me a little bit more time to focus on things. But I think it's fascinating you're able to do all this stuff from home because previous has always been like, I'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. Figure it out fast and, you know, get it out. I've always been fascinated by previous. I've never tried it myself, mm-hmm. but I've certainly got the idea of it.
Yeah.
I think especially really good previous artists are also really good directors and DPs, mm-hmm. and they understand cameras really well. So that's also something that's been very impressive. I actually had Colin Green on.
Oh, great.
So, you know, he's, you know, one of the OGs of the previous movement.
Oh yeah. Well, it's funny cause I hadn't, you know, I'd known about Colin for years and years cause I, you know, PLF, we worked with PLF on Van Helsing and so I knew about it. But I actually didn't meet him until I was doing, you know, on stage doing virtual production stuff. But yeah, he's just definitely an OG for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about this virtual production thing because, you know, I've always sort of been interested in virtual production and, you know, but mostly what I've been interested in is final rendering. Right. But I wasn't until we started goofing around on, I don't want to say goofing around, but we were working on this construct short that I said, what if those are the same thing? What if I could see it and see it much closer to final image than it ever been before. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really started to think about virtual production as such an important tool because before it was just called, you know, motion capture.
Yeah.
But the minute the camera actually got involved, mm-hmm. then it became a lot more than that. And then it became more about actually making the movie.
Right.
How has that affected you and what were some of the tools and stuff that sort of enabled you to take that to the next level?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, obviously virtual production has a huge history at DD. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, having done Jungle Book and then Ready Player One, those were big, massive shows. I mean, I think there's kind of, for me, it's always been sort of two different flavors. I mean, originally virtual production was like a full-blown, you know, it's almost like a shoot, right? It's a motion capture shoot. But you've got camera, you've got the DP, you've got, you know, everyone on stage. It's not necessarily right for every project, but for certain full CG projects, it's like the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like having that end of the spectrum and then also, you know, my background, which is more in traditional previs and kind of, you know, it's almost like comparing storyboarding to previs, you know, it's like way more traditional, way more linear. And then you have the full blown virtual production side. And so I think, you know, having, you know, run our stages and overseen that those departments at DD now getting a taste, you know, having done, you know, supervised mocap shoots and getting into all of that. I mean, it's fascinating. I feel like, you know, the biggest tools are obviously virtual camera and the ability to marker up whatever you can dream up to
right.
gather motion from. Obviously having characters and being able to capture that stuff quickly, and then choreography. I mean, for certain things, like, you know, when you're designing a oneer or something that requires choreography of human movement, it's, you know, it's the only way to do it, and just so fast, where you can just go down and, you know, especially if you have performers, like if you have a stunt team, you know, it's amazing what you can get done. I mean, I remember, you know, just on a smaller level, and you know, and it can scale, right? Like it's, you can do stuff where you're on a full, you know, our giant mocap stage down in Playa, or, you know, like when we were on Black Panther, we had X-Men suits out there. And, you know, a lot of times during the previs process, they do stunt viz, you know, they'll bring on a stunt right. coordinator and they'll have the stunt guys and they'll make their own previs just with their stunt actors. And once they, you know, all those fights, like when they were fighting in the Warrior Falls in the water mm-hmm. area, like all those were choreographed. And so what I did is just then brought X-Men suits, put the actors in X-Men suits. They went through their whole routine. We captured all of it. The next day we had it in Maya and we're doing cameras on it. So, I mean, stuff like that, like that's where it's a, you know, that would take forever, to hand key. I remember to compare it, like the disc battle in Tron Legacy.
Yeah.
That they did the same thing. They had stunt viz, but then I had to have a character animator, Kelvin Lee, basically right. went through that whole thing and animated, just basically matched it, you know,
as hand animated,
hand animated it, you know, yeah. and it took weeks.
So like Rotomation kind
of. Yeah. You know, as opposed to just putting on, you know, that's where like the X-Men suits are amazing just because the quality's gotten so good and, you know, it's good enough for previs. And
now they get the Rococo suits that they cost like $3,000.
Yeah.
For the whole suit.
Yeah. So,
it's crazy.
You know, just the cost of that. And then obviously, you know, the VR side of stuff, being able to scout stuff, you know, on a recent film, you know, we had done a bunch of traditional previs, but then they had, there was a particular set that they wanted to design. It was going to be full CG. It was like a postage stamp set. So only certain things would be practical. And so what they did is we had, you know, someone build it all in Unreal and then scouted it on our stage with VR goggles and, you know, kind of made adjustments there and just kind of got sign off and then went in and basically streamed in a lot of the previs that we had already done traditionally into the engine and right. then shot camera on it. So, you know, again, that's not quite full tilt like Ready Player One where you're doing performance capture and you have the actors and you're doing that, but it's like kind of mixing, you know, traditional previs with virtual production and, you know, just having that flexibility. I mean, I feel like that's one of the most interesting things about virtual production is like now that we have these different tools established, like what is the best use for each tool on each job? Because every director is different. Some directors want to direct the whole thing and they want to have it all, you know, in the volume live. That's one way of doing it. Then obviously there's other ones where they have, you know, it's more of an action scene that would be really difficult to, like if you're dealing with superheroes, I mean, how are you going to capture a lot of that, right? You're still going to have to keyframe a lot of that. So mixing that, but then using the engine as like a sandbox where, you know, you can come in and view things quickly and you can look at a higher quality render and sort of get that, you know, eye candy and sell the vibe of the scene. But then still be able to go into traditional methods, to quickly figure out story and camera and all of that thing. Cause I mean, even like Ready Player One, I mean, you know, we did all the virtual production, but before we did the virtual production, I mean, we did months and months and months of traditional previs. Because there's no way they would have been able to do that. It would have been so expensive if they would have just been like, oh, we're just going to show up and shoot it. I mean, it was exactly like you would do on a live action film, except, you know, the live action component of it was all virtual.
Right.
So it's interesting. I mean, I still think, you know, it really depends on the project. You know, every show is different. But then another aspect of that that's been really interesting is, you know, the art department starting to get into the engine and starting to use it for, you know, their design work. But what's fantastic about it is that now it's like a, you know, it's a sandbox that we can easily connect to. It's not like, because before, you know, they would be modeling in Rhino and SketchUp and all these different applications. And we, you know, the first thing we'd have to do is get all those models, remodel all of them so that they'll, you know, work well in Maya, probably retexture some of the stuff. But now if they're working in the engine, then it's just like, oh, it's ready to go. Like I can, I've taken, you know, Unreal projects from the production designer, plugged it straight into our mocap stage, and then we're looking around with virtual camera and VR, VR headsets. And so to me, that's what's amazing, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, we're working on a couple of projects now where we're trying to figure out like, how do we continue that? Because what happens a lot is that, you know, art department's in a vacuum, Previs is in a bit of a vacuum, you know, they're working on their set builds, their design. We have a gun to our head about getting action sequences figured out. So we're just going to make stuff up and do what we have to do. Obviously, we'll use as much as the art department stuff as we can. But if they can't keep up, we'll forge ahead. But what I love about the engine side is that if they're working on an environment and they're really, you know, it's a complex environment, they're doing lighting studies, all these different things. Meanwhile, we can be prevising and then we can put those tent pole shots in that engine. And then they can evaluate that again. You know, it's not like, you know.
Yeah, you guys work together.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. As a, you know, because I mean, trust me, over the years, like.
Yeah, because there's a feedback loop, right? So you can find it's because the problem has always been with this is not Previs, but the entire filmmaking process has been this story of handing it off and wishing someone good luck, right? And that's the way it used to be before, when you know, like you're a CG artist or whatever, and you're like, here's the design, that's it. You never talk to the art director or whoever created that piece of concept art. And you're like, okay, I guess I'll just make that. Right.
Yeah.
But now it's like this back and forth. Yep. I remember when I sat next to David Levy on Tron, you know, and he and I worked together on that whole light bank sequence. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. So, that's important. That's great.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah. So I think that's where we're trying and you know, we're still working it out because obviously with the engine comes all these other, you know, technical hurdles and, you know, it's a whole different paradigm. I mean, that's where I've been really trying to tinker with it on my own time. And, you know, it's a tough nut to crack. I mean, just having done Maya for so many years and, you know, I've always been interested in how in pipeline and kind of methodology and, you know, designing tools and stuff. And so now the challenge of making something that's fast enough, because my goal is to not have, you know, virtual production and traditional Previs be different things. It's kind of like, well, this is just another tool. Like we're just doing Previs or Viz, if you will. And, you know, we may do some of this stuff in engine. We may do some of it out of engine. You know, we may do some of this live. We may do some of this traditionally. So trying to treat it all as just one big thing and not getting too hung up on whether it's virtual production or not. Cause I mean, and every project's different, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah, it's interesting. That's really interesting. I didn't realize how much the art departments are starting to go into engine as well. It makes sense though, right?
Oh yeah. No, for sure.
Yeah. Well, what about, you know, because obviously, as you know, I have a passion for lighting. What about lighting studies, you know, and how that works now? Because I don't think you didn't, I mean, if I think about Previs 10, 15 years ago, it wasn't really lit. It was just kind of blocked out as much.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, even like I remember I worked a lot with, it depends on the show because every show, it depends on how collaborative the DP is. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked with some that just get pissed off at me because it's not right and it's not how they want to do it. But then I've had other ones that, you know, I forget Amir's name, but he was Michael Bay's DP. He's a pretty gruff guy, but we ended up getting along really well because he'd come in and be like, you know, what is this? This is wrong. And I'm like, all right, well, let's fix it. Like, how should it be? Let's do it. So, you know, we used to have those sessions. They weren't quite as, you know, formalized, but yeah, with the engine now, obviously you can do it in Blender or Maya as well, as far as light studies, there's various setups, but yeah, I think that's one of the most important things about it, because I think one of the, just to talk about, you know, the engine is amazing. The only thing that I run into that can be difficult is how it looks so good that it's almost like a shiny object that you kind of lose what your job is. You know, you're just so drawn to it that you forget that your job is to design the story, right?
Right.
And to figure out the sequence. And so you can get really lost in, oh, look how amazing that is. But that being said, you know, I think that's what's one of the really strong points about it is that, hey, I can go in here, I can make it night, I can make it day, I can make it, you know, I can change, you know, add atmosphere and all these things in real time. And I think that's one of the most amazing things about it. And so, again, that's all these projects that I'm currently working on, trying to figure out, you know, how can we do this? And we're even talking about where, you know, we've got shows where, you know, visual effects is trying to get, is starting to come on early, VFX soups and animation directors and whatnot, and starting to do tests. And we're talking about, okay, well, let's, what if we throw that into the engine? Because then we can also play around with lighting in real time. We can hook it up to our VCAM. You know, again, it's the sandbox where you can really crank out a bunch of different ideas and ideate and mm-hmm. speed it up. And that's what it's for, you know, because currently Previz, you know, that's not the final pixel. So I think right. that's where it's like, okay, well, that's the balance, because you can, unless, you know, of course, obviously with LED walls and all of that, that's a whole other thing. But I feel like the, you know, the holy grail is like, how do you, and you and I even talked about this, right? With the, right. With rendering, and how do you invest in the engine at that early stage and look dev and all of that, and then figure out ways to extract all of that and make sure that it's right. all usable and, you know, more than a guide, ideally.
Right.
I mean, and even a guide, it can be good in some ways, because at least it's a creative outlet for you to kind of explore different ideas quickly.
Well, there was a lot of things that, you know, when we were doing Construct, we were thinking about what it was and how to work with it, because back then the game engines were not really a thing. We were still using Motion Builder,
mm-hmm.
We had basically, you know, a real ray trace camera,
right.
and we were looking at it in real time.
Right.
But they started thinking about things that I never thought about. Like they built a focus puller for Motion mm-hmm. Builder, mm-hmm. because you could do real depth of field in ray tracing, and suddenly mm-hmm. like, and of course that's something that's always missing a little bit, right?
Yeah.
There's always been like, I wish it had a little bit of depth of field and make it more cinematic.
Yep.
And so those types of things are really interesting to plan. And also it's like something that's a guide for, you know, DP, like, okay, mm-hmm. you know, on this one, we're going to use an F2, we're going to use an F8 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so really know how to plan for those things.
Yeah. And you get it for free a lot of times. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, you can just quickly go in and set that stuff up. Because we used to do comps, you know, we would do depth of field all the time, but we'd have to do it in comp passes, you know?
Right. Yeah. 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 Well, we built V-Ray to run inside of Unreal.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
So that's, I mean, that was kind of the idea, is like, okay, mm-hmm. well, you can look the way you want it Unreal, but if you want to gut check it and see what it looks like ray traced, we can do that as well. Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting. Now, okay, I want to go back a little bit. Now that we talked about the Previz and working from home, how is the virtual production from home?
Mm-hmm.
Have you started doing any of that? You mentioned the VR pan shot.
Yeah,
that
doing Google Earth with VR. Yeah.
That's cool. That's a really good idea. But I mean, what else are you doing? Do you have like a suit at home? Do you do AR kit and just figure things out?
Yeah, I mean, the most... You know, I've got a Vive set up here. I had one of our XN suits that I was using here briefly. It's back at the studio now. But what I've been kind of focusing on is what we can do remotely and collaboratively. So one of the things, you know, the biggest issue is hardware and setting it up for people that aren't technically inclined. So if you want to do anything, you know, that requires VR, that means they're going to have a physical box that you're going to have to deploy to them, which can be done. But, you know, there's the VPN setup, there's the connectivity, you know, their internet connection, all of that. So that's kind of the full blown version where, you know, you could have someone on our stage and a mocap. And we've done shoots like this, like we've done virtual production shoots where, you know, there's like three of us on stage, directors somewhere else. And that's just...
Yep.
Basically, you know, a video conference call, kind of like we're doing now with iPads on stands and just communication, and that works really well, and that's fairly simple. You know, when you're doing like the multi,
and you have got that to work. So you've gotten people from many locations, and then the mocap stage is very sparse.
Yep.
But everyone's looking at it from home. Okay.
Yeah, we worked with Matthew Butler on his film that he's working on, and Barry St. John. Like, we were basically, you know, they came down, and it was just a small crew, and we were running all of our previs through Unreal, and then had VCam, and then and then did some performance capture and did camera on that, and that was all. The director was, you know, basically connecting from Sweden to watch the sessions, and that was all great. That worked fine. I mean, we've done several mocap shoots. I mean, we did a 10-man mocap shoot. I mean, obviously that was different. Everyone had to get tested, and that was more about, you know, just the protocol of COVID and masks and hand washing and breaks and all that stuff. But then on the, like, the engine kind of virtual production side of it, what I've been kind of focusing in on is a setup that we've made, where I'm just using an Xbox controller. I know it's been around for a long time, but basically a virtual camera that's all, you know, using an Xbox controller. And what's cool is there are applications out there where you can, you could have an Xbox controller at your house, and that's all you need. You plug it in, and then you connect to my machine at my house, and you're driving the VCam. And so then I'm there adjusting everything, and I'm just basically like, okay, are you ready? Let's roll. And then I hit record. You're operating the camera, but it has a very low footprint. I mean, all you need is a decent internet connection and an Xbox controller. Right. So that's what I've been kind of looking at, is stuff that's simpler. I mean, I know there's all sorts of different, you know, flavors of things, you know, running stuff in the cloud and streaming, and, you know, there's different, I know that, you know, Unreal's released all sorts of different executables that you can send and scout, and, you know.
Someone said that there's an iPhone app that basically uses ARKit, and it connects directly to Maya, and it costs $50.
Yep. No, I've used that one, and there's and then the Unreal one. I mean, you know, it's for free as well. It's ARKit. You know, I know a lot of people, we've talked to folks, you know, about, I know a lot, there's been a lot of where you basically set up animation and you use ARKit so that you can at least just kind of see where it lives on set. You know, building those sorts of tools, just for kind of AR, you know, type of stuff. We haven't done so much of it recently. A lot of it just kind of comes down to what the clients really want and need. And I feel like that's the biggest challenge with all of this. It's like, there's so many things that can be done, but are they actually going to use it? Is it actually going to be meaningful?
And, well, I think people are trying everything.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So, but I think that, I mean, so here, you know, here we are, we're many months into this pandemic with no end in sight, and film at an all-time demand of high demand for content because everyone's at home. And you guys, a lot of people are going to be making content. So what you're doing, I mean, isn't that really going to change filmmaking completely? It's not just previs anymore. You're like, you're making movies now. And I'm not necessarily saying you're doing the final image, but there's a lot of stuff that you can be doing. It's actually like, why not just do it all the way you're doing it?
For sure. And I think a lot of it's kind of more, and it's less about individual tools necessarily, but the whole methodology behind filmmaking, you know, like, I mean, obviously it kind of depends. Like, if you're talking about LED walls, because obviously we've had tons of conversations with different clients, you know, I know everyone's trying to figure out how they can work that, or how does that help them, or does it help them? I feel like that, you know, that's a whole other different conversation.
Don't ask Lou about that question.
Yeah. Because it's hard, because you get all these people that aren't technical people, and they see these demos and they're like, well, why can't we just do that? It's like, well, because it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work for everything. I mean,
he said people are literally saying, let's Mandalorian it.
Yeah.
I know.
And you know, I hate it, because I don't want to sound negative, but it's like, it's not the magic bullet. I mean, think about it. Then you can't change your mind. Think about how many times you've changed your mind on a shot, and that's all baked in. But I think if you have a project where the creative is thinking about that going into it, you know, I feel like certain films, it could be perfect. You know, like if you're in some sort of an enclosed space and it makes sense for the story, you know, Mandalorian, obviously it worked just because of the types of landscapes. But, you know, I had a call where we were, you know, they were looking at like a period piece that they wanted to do with LED walls. And just like, you realize just even making that full CG traditional visual effects would be very difficult with cloth and texture, you know, just, yeah. You know, that's why you build sets. So anyway, and not to mention, you know, convincing the studio and the different departments, because now we have this infrastructure of like art department that they're used to, like, oh, we have this amount of money for a set build. And now they're going to have to go in and say, hey, we're not spending any money on the set build. We're putting that into the LED wall now. So this whole department may go away or is much more reduced. And, you know, like, what does that mean, you know, to the whole industry? And so there's all those different types of things. So anyway, I'm trying to get back to what our original question was.
We're changing filmmaking, and I think that's
Oh, right. Oh, right. Yeah. I remember what it was. It was more just about the planning of it. I mean, I feel like, because in my mind, you're spending, it's like previs on steroids where you're really, so, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about is like, okay, say I do a film tomorrow and I get to pitch, you know, the methodology for it. So in my mind, you start with traditional previs. Then once you get the flow of the action sequences and everyone's happy and they're liking the story and everything, then you start saying, okay, what don't you like? Let's get the DP in here. Let's change the lighting. And then we take those previous scenes, we get them into the engine, we do virtual camera type scenario, and basically so they can make their mark on it. They can conceive the cameras exactly how they see them. And then again, you're just rinse and repeat on the sequences for the movie. And then now you're developing even further. Okay, now we're ready to shoot, but we've narrowed it down and we know that, you know, we only need to shoot this, this, and this. And then we have tech viz because it's all, we've been doing it all virtually. So we can go back and we can plant, we can take every single shot that we've done. We can reconstruct it. We can give diagrams and schematics for how everything is laid out. And even if you wanted to take it a step further, you could even put in the zones for COVID. You could talk about, you could use it all in the planning and, you know,
yeah.
And basically you try to plan as much as you can in pre-production. And literally the filming is more like a second unit, you know, pickup shoot kind of a thing, or reshoot, you know, much more strategic, much more calculated. I just feel like that's kind of, if things stay the way they are, that's kind of where things will have to go, because then, you know, you can't, you know, the onset scene is already completely different, you know?
Right.
And so it's just going to continue to change.
For sure. For sure. Well, Scott, this has been amazing. I think this is a really cool, that people have to learn about this stuff, especially now, and like how it's going to affect their jobs and how it's going to affect filmmaking. So it's really cool. I really appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely. Well, it's great talking to you and great to kind of think back through all the history of things. So thanks for that.